It's hard to talk about controlling greenhouse gases without also talking about China. That country produces even more tons of carbon dioxide than the United States, and the problem could get worse. China's coal mines are being told they must bring even more coal to the surface. NPR senior news analyst Ted Koppel went underground to get this story.
At the Datong coal mine in Chongqing province, as in mines all over China, they're working around the clock, at least a couple of times a week, and certainly with an American reporter preparing to join a crew of miners at the coalface. The shift begins with a safety briefing and a chorus of safety slogans, punctuated by the men punching their fists in the air. "I am proud to be a coal miner here," the men chant. "We have only one life to live, and safety is the most important thing." Actually, China has the worst coal mine safety record in the world. Only 2 months ago, 105 men were killed in one mine. Last year, approximately 3,800 miners were killed in accidents. This despite China's claim that it has closed over 10,000 of the country's most dangerous mines. The first leg of our journey is straight down in the cage. The trip, some 1,200 feet, takes just over a minute. We walk and ride a couple of pommel lifts deeper and about 2 miles into the mine. It takes almost an hour before we reach a small tunnel, the ceiling of which is supported by steel beams held in place by thick cylinders raised by pneumatic power. There is about 4.5 feet of headroom, and we crawl crab-like for about 150 yards. Two members of a three-man crew are operating a giant drill. The bit is about 8 or 10 feet long. As the drill chews into the coal face, the third member of the crew holds up a cell phone-sized device that measures the release of coal gas into the tunnel. When I ask one of the miners whether his wife doesn't resent the fact that he's been forced to work while the rest of China celebrates the recent Lunar New Year's holiday, he laughs and says she likes the money. China, which until last year was a net exporter of coal, will, it's estimated, have to import 15 million tons more this year than it sends overseas. The hardest winter in decades and a ravenous economic engine is placing a huge demand on China's coal industry. It's a simple and brutal equation. The country's blistering economy has been growing at 10% a year, and it's a pace the government is determined to maintain. Last year, the Datong mine produced 1.5 million tons. They've been given a new target of 2.3 million tons annually. The Chinese government is under huge pressure to improve mine safety and to reduce pollution. But 80% of China's power is generated by burning coal. China's leadership in Beijing may be less dependent on popular support than their American counterparts in Washington, but they're getting the same message. It's the economy, stupid. This is Ted Koppel in Datong, China.
If you want to find out where all that coal is going, look for this story. NPR's Louisa Lim explored the impact that coal is having on one Chinese village. And you can see an audio slideshow at npr.org.
The Rocky Mountains received a record amount of snow this winter. And as the weather warms up, some communities are worried about flooding. In Leadville, Colorado, the runoff could put hundreds of residents of a mobile home park and a nearby river at risk. NPR's Jeff Brady explains.
More than a century ago, mining was king in Leadville. But now, this Victorian town at 10,000 feet above sea level is a tourist attraction. Head north on the main street a few miles and you'll find the Village of East Fork Mobile Home Park and a teenager shoveling snow. From here, he can see a tunnel 2 blocks away that leads into the mountain. Inside, there's a maze of old mines, many of them collapsed, that goes on for miles. The groundwater level has been rising, flooding those mines with 1 billion gallons of water, picking up heavy metals and other pollutants in the process. Locals worry that nasty water will find its way into the nearby Arkansas River. All this snow melting is increasing the water pressure underground, and now officials worry it could break free and come pouring out the tunnel.
They told us it could happen at any time.
Emily Medina lives in the mobile home park.
So we're really in danger. Even the kids, if I leave my son here and I go to work, it could happen when he comes from school or I leave him here so he can get the bus. You never know when. We can even be sleeping and this can happen.
Medina says it's difficult living under that kind of stress.
If I would have known this 9 years ago that I brought my modular, me and my husband, I wouldn't have moved here at all. But they didn't let us know nothing.
Last week, the county's three commissioners declared a state of emergency. Their goal was to get the attention of the Bureau of Reclamation, which is responsible for the tunnel, and it worked. Don Luma is an assistant regional director with the agency. He says the declaration came as a surprise because the Bureau monitors groundwater movement there constantly.
We don't think that the tunnel is going to blow out tomorrow, if you will. But we have some folks that are concerned about it and think maybe, you know, they think it might. So we're going to make sure we go out and look at that and take that very seriously.
Luma says his agency is spending $100,000 on a study to learn more about what's happening in the tunnel. Results are expected by the end of June. Until then, he's reassuring residents that if the water starts moving, they'll have at least 24 hours to evacuate. Luma says it would have to push through a lot of rock and dirt before reaching the trailer park.
We do think we'd be able to know that something was going on long before it actually hit down at the tunnel portal.
So would you feel safe living in front of that tunnel?
Right now, yeah. You know, I don't have a life and limb concern personally. Now, I do take their concerns personally. I'm not living in front of that tunnel. They are.
The Bureau of Reclamation's response is encouraging, says Lake County Commissioner Ken Olson.
We ought to address it sooner than later. I don't want to wait and explain later what the degree of threat is. I'd rather just address it and alleviate it, and it's a singular fix, and that's lowering the groundwater level.
Olson wants the federal government to divert the snowmelt and other sources of clean water into the Arkansas River before it gets polluted down in the mines. But that would require pumps and flumes costing millions of dollars, much more than his rural county could ever afford. Olson and his fellow commissioners hope the federal government and its treasury will come to the rescue. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Denver.
Here is a wild outdoors question. What happened to the jackrabbits? Where did they go, and why hasn't anyone noticed? Jackrabbits are the rangy, sort of grizzly bunnies of the American West. They're common as tumbleweed, or they used to be. An article in the conservation journal Oryx notes that the white-tailed jackrabbit has disappeared from Yellowstone and Grand Teton National Parks in Wyoming in all that's about 20,000 square miles. Joel Berger is the author. He works for the Wildlife Conservation Society, and he's a professor at the University of Montana in Missoula. Joel, welcome back to Day to Day. And when did the jackrabbits disappear?
In Grand Teton Park, there have been three sightings in the last 3.5 decades. Prior to that, it seems that they were progressively less abundant, but were abundant in around the 1920s. In Yellowstone Park, records from the 1870s indicate that they were widespread, diminishing to a tiny, tiny corner of the park currently.
So why have they disappeared? Do you know?
Nobody seems to know why. The difficulty, of course, first knowing that they disappeared or have become so reduced, and then secondly, it's really hard to recreate the history of a loss.
So what difference does the presence of jackrabbits make in Yellowstone?
White-tailed jackrabbits, like many other rabbits, play a role because they're food for some of the larger predators, in this case for coyotes. And so when rabbits become so diminished, we know that coyotes turn to other prey species. And in our particular case, we know that they've been eating pronghorn fawns and also elk calves.
So baby antelopes and elks, that's what they're going after instead.
More so antelope babies, and there's some data to confirm that they're also eating elk babies. And the reason that this is important is because, of course, keep in mind, with wolves reintroduced, there's been great attention and focus on not only wolves, but also grizzly bears. And I think some of the small things that run the world have fallen off the radar.
Have jackrabbits disappeared from the rest of the American West? I mean, they're incredibly common, I think.
What we're seeing across the West is the sagebrush and grassland systems in jeopardy. And sage grouse have been potentially petitioned for listing for endangered species status. Pygmy rabbits are a very small and beautiful little bunny. and white-tailed jackrabbits are doing all right in many areas, but in both of these parks, they have strikingly reduced ranges.
Your paper notes their passing from these parks, but then you go on to something that seems just as troubling to you, which is that hardly anyone seemed to notice.
And that's the interesting part, because I think as conservationists and as scientists, you know, we need to look and consider all of the parts of the puzzle and how the system works if we ever want to restore it. But if something blips off and we don't know about it, then we're going to be remiss in our mission.
How is it that scientists could miss the disappearance of something like the jackrabbit?
You know, I think we're all blinded, and myself included. And as we focus on species that are bigger than a bread box, we miss a lot of the important things that help operate and run and are fascinating in our world.
Joel Berger, he's a field biologist for the Wildlife Conservation Society and a professor at the University of Montana. Joel, thank you.
It's a pleasure as always, Alex.
Ever since the 1970s, there's been a steady stream of new diseases. Think of some of the famous names: Ebola, AIDS, bird flu, SARS, West Nile. That raises a question whether the rate of new infections is increasing, or if it just seems that way. Some researchers writing in the journal Nature have come up with an answer, and NPR's Richard Knox has it.
The researchers scoured the scientific literature back to 1940. Over 7.5 decades, they counted 335 new infectious diseases. The number increased steadily with a sudden peak in the 1980s. Mark Levy of Columbia University says the peak was probably due to the large numbers of Africans who were infected with HIV by then.
In the 80s, you had millions of people suddenly with suppressed immune systems. Therefore, a bunch of new diseases took root.
In the 1990s, the number of emerging diseases fell back by a quarter, but the overall curve is steadily up. Peter Daszak heads the Consortium for Conservation Medicine at the Wildlife Trust.
We can, for the first time, definitively say that emerging diseases are increasing over time. One thing's for sure, they're on the rise. So in the next decade, we can expect more emerging diseases.
The study also uncovers some important patterns. For instance, about two-thirds of all emerging infections since 1940 have gone from animals to humans, and most of those were from wild, not domestic, animals. The researchers say wild animal infections pose the biggest risk of new emerging diseases. Even though Daszak is one of the world's leading experts in wildlife diseases, he was surprised.
Everybody talks about emerging diseases that come from wildlife. And we know that a few key ones do, like Ebola, and they, you know, they can be very scary diseases. But I didn't expect that emerging diseases from wildlife would be increasing over time.
The researchers say that's because human populations are encroaching more and more on wildlife habitat. That gives an opportunity to whatever viruses and bacteria lurk in the animals. Kate Jones of the London Zoological Society says the analysis gives conservationists like her a powerful new argument.
The conservation voices have always been downplayed in the development community. This shows that there is a cost to development and that it may be cost-effective to keep wild areas wild, that it may stop the next emerging disease coming from those areas.
It doesn't mean that development should stop, Jones says, but more attention should be given to those hot spots that the researchers say are ripe for new infections to emerge, and buffer zones should be maintained between humans and wildlife. Animal diseases aren't the only threat. About 20% of new diseases are resistant bacteria that result from overuse of antibiotics. The hot spots for these are zones of increasing population growth, places like India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh, where people are getting just enough money to buy over-the-counter medicines. Daszak says the group's research provides a tool to do something about emerging diseases.
You know, this isn't a complete doom and gloom scenario. Sure, emerging diseases are increasing, but here we have a potential strategy to start to deal with them.
The starting points are those hot spots the researchers have identified. Daszak says that's where scientists should focus their attention. Richard Knox, NPR News.
All right, here's one more thing to think about as your stock portfolio slowly makes its way into the sewer system. Some of the country's biggest investors are starting to look more skeptically at projects that have a heavy carbon footprint. NPR's Christopher Joyce reports on climate risk.
Investors make billions of dollars from financing energy projects. They've been a reliable source of profit. So when a bank like J.P. Morgan Chase recently decided that investing in power plants that burn coal might be getting risky, there was a reason. Bank Vice President Eric Fornell says it's the taint of carbon dioxide.
It is very likely that Congress will impose some type of system that will raise the cost for those who emit CO2. And we think that that's a significant change in attitude that's taken place in the last 2 years.
Congress is debating about a dozen bills that would slap some kind of limit on carbon dioxide, the biggest greenhouse gas. And that's one of the reasons J.P. Morgan and other big banks now say they want to know more about how much carbon a new project will emit before they invest in it. What they're trying to get a handle on is climate risk. Several hundred investors met recently in New York City to talk about how to lower their climate risk. The meeting was sponsored by the United Nations Foundation and Ceres, a coalition of investors and environmental groups led by Mindy Luber.
Companies are at risk if they're not looking at what their climate change impact is. They'll get sued, or their reputation could easily be harmed, or they'll find huge additional costs, or for that matter, be unfortunately in the area where there are huge physical impacts that will cost them billions of dollars.
Physical impacts, she says, like Katrina-sized hurricanes. Now, it's serious business to ring alarms about climate change. And in fact, Congress is still a long way from putting a price on carbon emissions, so this risk isn't imminent. But people who invest are paying attention. Nancy Kopp, for example. She's treasurer of the state of Maryland, which has some $39 billion worth of pension funds to invest.
We're going to continue to invest in companies. What we want to know is whether they're aware of all of the potential costs and benefits that are facing them, and therefore whether it's priced into our investment.
Costs created by bigger storms, or the availability of water supplies, or other consequences of climate change that scientists expect to see. Kopp is one of several state treasurers who, along with the Ceres Coalition, have filed a petition with the Securities and Exchange Commission in Washington. They want the SEC to make companies disclose more about their carbon emissions. The SEC so far doesn't agree, and nor do many companies. Some companies do reveal their carbon footprint voluntarily, though, such as Pacific Gas and Electric, the California utility. They're also trying to shrink their footprint by encouraging customers to use less electricity. As CEO Peter Darby points out, that's not just an act of goodwill.
We may face an experience 30 or 40 years down the road, or maybe less, where people conclude that CO2 was a pollutant, and those companies that don't get with the program could very well be held accountable at a later date and face billions of dollars of lawsuits, as has been the case, for example, with asbestos.
Despite the bad rep carbon is getting, investors are still putting plenty of money into carbon-heavy projects like coal and gas-fired power plants. They do make money. And so far, alternative energy accounts for only 2% of world energy supply. But green energy projects are growing. Wind power in the U.S., for example, increased by 45% last year, faster than ever. And an economic analysis just out from the McKinsey Global Institute, a green-leaning consulting firm, says investing in ways to save energy could also be a moneymaker. The world could cut its energy appetite by half, McKinsey says, if investors put $170 billion into the right mix of projects. That may sound like a lot of money, but the sponsors of the New York meeting claimed their audience controls some $10 trillion in capital. They just have to convince those investors that green energy projects aren't a throw of the dice. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
And our last word in business today is about another little being whose life is not so smurfy these days, honeybees. For the last year and a half, honeybee colonies in the United States have been collapsing due to a mysterious disorder. Bee pollination is needed for the growth of many fruits, berries, and nuts, so this becomes a business story, and that's why Häagen-Dazs is getting involved. The fancy ice cream company says 40% of its flavors require the work of honeybees, so it has launched a Help the Honeybee campaign. It's donating $250,000 to the University of California and Penn State University to fund research into the bee crisis. And that's the business news on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.